everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast. It is Thursday, May 10th, 2018, and we are live in Mountain View, California at Shoreline Amphitheater at day three of Google I.O. And this is a live podcast. So what you're hearing,
yeah, that's true.
You can actually see this live, sort of, on YouTube if you watched it before when it was being streamed live. I don't know how time works.
If you're capable of time travel, go back to yesterday, and we're using a Lenovo Mirage Solo to broadcast this from a VR180 camera.
Right, which Russell, whose voice you're hearing, really likes.
Yeah, so, it's a decent little camera.
We won't talk about that because we have a lot of other stuff to get through. It is, of course, Google I.O., which means that we're talking about products and services that Google has announced. So we'll go through the table because there's a special guest that I'd like to introduce you to. But first, to my left, Andrew Martinick. Welcome. How are you?
I am doing just fine. I took an allergy pill, so I will not be sniffling during this podcast.
But debatable.
Also, we're in a big box.
Yeah, it's non-drowsy. I'm okay.
Okay.
I'm good. That mellifluous voice you hear is Alex Dobie.
I'm going to look at that word later. Thank you.
That is Alex Dobie, who traveled the furthest to get here, I think, of all of us. So, how are you? Are you jet lagged?
I'm good. I'm holding up. I've been here for a few days now.
Yeah, it's more beer lag at this point.
Well, yeah, that as well. But yeah, 15-hour time change from where I was before. So
that's brutal.
More or less recovered, and then I'm recovered thanks to the beer lag. Yeah, beer lag.
Russell Hawley.
Hello.
The aforementioned. Who's here on for the first time in a few years, right?
Yeah, I took this is actually my first of the outdoor IOs. I did a bunch of the indoor IOs at the Moscone, and then when they said we were doing this outdoors, I was like, "Nah, I'm cool. I'll stay behind."
Because you were probably good to miss the first year.
Yeah,
there was a lot of teething issues that first year.
Yeah, and then second year was better. This year has been great. So far so good. And last but not least, Igor Bonifacic from Mobile Syrup, my alma mater. We're really happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I'm such a huge fan of everything Android Central does.
I'm a huge fan of Mobile Syrup, actually. I mean, just, you know, it has nothing to do with the fact that I worked there for 5 years. But yeah.
But also everything to do with the fact.
Nothing, Andrew. Nothing to do. All right, let's get started. So we want to do this sort of chronologically, because I think that makes the most sense. We'll start from the beginning of the keynote and work our way to the end, which was Android by and large, but we'll spend probably the most amount of time on Android. So let's get through the other things first. And
yeah,
that was mainly Sundar Pichai coming on stage and talking about how AI is really shaping the future of Google, right?
Yeah.
And he said the same things last year and to some extent the year before, but this year it's sort of a little bit more concrete, and we're seeing the fruits of that in products like Google Lens, like Google Photos, and even in Gmail. So we'll start there. Gmail's getting Smart Compose.
Totally forgot about this.
That was one of the first products that was announced. Kind of cool. It's already rolling out. Is it something that we should be excited about?
I think sort of the idea of it is more impressive than will be the reality of actually using it. It's...
They showed it in use on the desktop, which is the weirdest thing to me, because you have a full keyboard in front of you.
We all type faster than we can write, or in some cases even think. So, I don't know. Google has showed off features like this in the past, where I think one of their chat apps at one point had it so you could actually see the other person typing in real time.
Yeah.
These features don't always make it into, you know, widespread usage, and I don't know. I think the average person who doesn't really understand AI in the sense that we do, if it's something that you have to explain to a person as to how and why it's doing it,
right?
I think it might be a case of Google maybe overreaching in terms of how much value this has to
average people. Yeah. Given that Smart Reply is already rolled out on desktop.
So yeah, Smart Reply makes sense because those are like quick, like one-liners, like just a few words. Useful on mobile because you can just say, you know, sounds good, or I'll be there, or whatever. Having it predict and then like lay out the rest of the sentence that you're currently writing, it's going to take, like you were saying, you Alex, you type, we all type pretty quickly.
Yeah.
we can finish typing the sentence that we're typing faster than we could read the suggestion and hit enter to go to the next line.
We can, but you're missing the generation of finger typers, like index finger typers.
Sure.
Peckers. The finger pecker people.
Pickle peppers.
I believe we call them hunt and peck typers.
Yes, that's correct.
That's an official term.
Those people probably love this feature.
It's a great button.
Sure. Assuming that they even know like where their tap button is. Not to be insulting, it's not a button that group is going to use.
But also, those are probably the people that think their email is getting hacked because it's writing for them.
Yeah, maybe. And look, this is, you mentioned smart replies there. There's something about, this makes me a little uneasy in the same way that smart replies make me uneasy, in that by giving you like canned responses to what is basically conversation, then maybe you remove something from the human element of that interaction.
And we will get to that later.
Oh, yes.
There is some serious innovation / terrifying news
foreshadowing
to report. Yes, this movie is going to end very badly.
Yeah. If I could just quickly, I think the big thing to remember with these keynotes is like they show us the best case scenario, which is not how these products always work out. When we talk about Duplex in a bit, it's that system is specifically built for those situations, and there might be situations where you're writing an email where its predictive abilities aren't really up to snuff for that the content of that email.
Yeah. Right. Oh yeah. So moving on from that, we have some Google Photos innovations. I think these are cool because, unlike in previous years, Google Photos announced a bunch of really interesting and kind of moonshot features that never actually got launched. You know,
fences are still everywhere.
Yeah. They're ruining photos.
I was really
all
looking
over
forward to Google just eliminating chain link fences once and for all, but they are a persistent nuisance.
Alas. This year, though, we're getting improvements to Assistant within Photos. Things like colorization.
But they're all suggested.
Right.
So it's one tap suggest. Like, you always had good editing options, but this is saying, I identified everything going on in this photo, tap one button, and it will just make the changes.
So this is a little bit different to what people see in the Assistant tab now, right?
Yeah.
It's actually something that it gifts you with, like
right.
a stylized thing or an animation or something like that. It's actually a feature when you're already looking at the photo that you want to
right.
it to do stuff to.
And but like you were saying, Daniel, the colorization one is probably the most impressive.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that'll be neat. I don't know how many black and white photos I have kicking around, but I think the digitization of archival photos is a thing that happens quite often in families. Mm-hmm. Google Photos, there's even a photo scan.
I think it's called Photo Scan.
Is it just called Photo Scan? But yeah, it's an easy way to digitize archival photos. This will take those and colorize them, which is neat.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see how good this turns out because, you know, the colorization of black and white photos is something that there's professional colorists who do that. They do thousands of hours of study to really get the tones
right.
So I'm just curious to see how good an AI in its current form does this.
And also, if we're looking mainly at older photos, what Google is identifying the real world now with the stuff that it's looking at.
Right.
Most of the photos it will be taken maybe in the past 20 years, if you want to be generous.
Sure.
100 years ago, that's a whole different kind of image recognition that you need to do. There are things that people use every day, the clothes that people wear. You can think of a number of different things that are just different about the way the world looked back then. It will be interesting to see how.
And that's an interesting question. Like, do you want them to be modern, or do you want them to actually be colorized
like steampunk somewhere in the middle?
Animate them.
Mm.
So
the batch sharing, though, the suggested sharing for groups of photos, like if it identifies a face and says, "Hey, with either these three photos, you can share with this person," I think that's probably the thing I'm going to use the most in this. Mm. Just because I do a lot of like the family photos when there's a party or something, and then I do nothing with those pictures. So
those are additions to existing sharing features.
Yeah, right. But it's the assistant automation that is going to make me use it. You know, like I have the ability to, like last year when they announced the ability to create like a shared folder for people to join in. That's cool, but I often don't end up using it that way.
Just to interrupt for a second, we are in a glass box
of emotions.
A physical glass box of emotions, and we are subject to the
dump trucks.
The ambient noises that
I was trying
around.
To figure out what that was. It was the AC firing.
Or we're under attack.
It could be the AC next door, actually. Anyway, so let's keep moving. So a lot of AI-based announcements early on, they're adding Morse code to Gboard to accommodate, you know, adding even more accessibility features to a suite that... So based on conversations we had with an attendee last night who's both an entrepreneur and an accessibility advocate, he says that Google is doing a better job with accessibility than even Apple today when it comes to certain things like input. And he also says that for people who want an Android phone that has the best accessibility features, it's only Pixel, right? Samsung, LG, they do not take accessibility seriously, or at least as seriously as he would like. So shout out JJ, because that was a really interesting and insightful conversation that we had. I really appreciated that. Moving along, am I missing anything before we move? Because I want to get to...
Let's talk Assistant.
Yeah, I want to get to Assistant. So, Alex, what's new in Assistant, and why should we care about John Legend?
I can answer at least one of those. But yeah, John Legend is now your Google Assistant. I love that.
Sort of. In specific situations,
which would be unexpected. And
you don't get a constant...
Yeah, there's no way to enable it just like...
It's not right now.
You don't get a John Legend.
And
I'm just
going to
sing the rest of this podcast.
Shout out to his wife, Chrissy Teigen, for making fun of him for like an hour during the keynote presentation while that was happening. Because that was a delight to read through.
Her Twitter profile is amazing.
So we now have finally fully digitized voices for Assistant. And this is a big deal because this is Google creating a voice entirely synthetically from scratch, as opposed to stitching together bits of pre-composed speech based on just having a person sat in a sound booth for hundreds of hours at a time.
It's creating a voice out of nothing from... It's like it's using AI to create a voice that is your gateway to the AI.
Yeah, which actually is how they do the John Legend thing as well.
Right.
Similar technology. Impressive. I mean, this gets into almost kind of uncanny valley territory with just the realism of it, I think.
Yep.
We're all used to listening to computerized voices that are badly done, and you just get used to it. I think when the voice is good, but just not quite there, I don't know. There was a little bit of just that sense of uneasiness.
It is getting close enough where you can identify it. You can still identify it as a robot voice, but it's a lot more comfortable to have a conversation with.
Yeah.
And that speaks to a couple of additions to and improvements to an Assistant. First, something that people have been clamoring for since Assistant was announced, continued conversations. This means that you won't have to say, hey, G, every time you want to activate...
Yo, G,
every time you want to activate Google with Google Assistant, and it can continue having... meaningful interactions and bundle a bunch of commands.
And they had some really good examples of understanding. It really was, obviously, it was on stage, so it was like perfect because
it had to be.
But it went through a lot of tough things on purpose where it had multiple actions strung together. And he explained that it's not as easy as understanding that something before and after an and are two different things, because he gave examples of, you know, where are this and this at, but then also, you know, where is this and how do I do that?
Right.
So like that, figuring out just the parts of the question is difficult.
And actually, that's something that a lot of computers or AI systems struggle to recognize, even in written text.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, you could argue that when it's spoken, it makes the nuance.
Siri.
that's the thing.
It makes that nuance easier to understand because you have a bunch of other information as well as just the words that are being said. You have the intonation and all the subtleties of speech that contribute to potentially to the way you're supposed to understand a command.
It's an important thing to keep in mind that Google Assistant was already the best at the human form interaction. Honestly, like you compare it to Siri, you compare it to Alexa.
The way that Google had structured commands and things like that, it was already the most natural seeming of that communication. And this really makes it an actual conversation. And that's mm-hmm. that's an important distinction. And it really highlights how far behind Alexa and Siri are at this part of it.
I mean, we talk about all the time how frustrating it is that you have to be specific with Alexa, like very specific with your commands. Even though in the US, it feels like Alexa is still slightly more capable in terms of the skills that it has, but Google is catching up quickly and to that end is rolling out things like custom routines, which will allow you to sort of create your own sets of actions, like combining things. So, you know, you can say, you know, hey, Google, good night. And you can combine now more than six actions into a single command, which is really neat.
Sure.
And that's rolling out soon.
Also for the parents out there, you can't forget the...
No. So, Igor, take us through this, because I think this is a really... I struggle with this. I'm not a parent yet, but and Russell, I want to get your take on this. But I find this to be a little bit prescriptive, given that this is a huge corporation telling us.
Right. Yeah. So they're introducing a feature which will both encourage and reward kids for being polite to Google Assistant. So if you know they say thank you, Assistant will say thank you back for being so kind to me. And it was really interesting because you know, I gave my cousin a Google Assistant this week, a Google Home Mini. And it was really interesting just to watch how quickly he became really bossy with Assistant.
Right.
He was like, okay, Google, do this. Okay, Google.
Jeez.
shame.
Thank you, Google. I mean, the one thing here, though, is, like you say, it's very prescriptive in the sense of how they want you to approach it. And do we really want, like, it's again kind of taking away something that should be a parent's role, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, outsourcing it to a product, which Russell, you probably have.
Yeah, I mean, as
way
a parent,
more thoughts.
You had experience with this on the Alexa stuff.
Yeah, I ended up having this conversation with Andrew the other day. Is that this is not replacing the parent's responsibility. It's really just a you know, kind of tangential reward. But it's also indicative of how we interact with a lot of these things to begin with. I am not nice to any of my virtual assistants.
No.
My like the number one thing that I say to Google Home Mini and the Echo Dot in my kitchen is shut up, because it's playing something and I want it. But and it's, you know,
they need to make it respond to shut up.
On one, that was the, yeah. I made a joke about that. Was that when I say shut up, I need Samuel L. Jackson to come back at me. but yeah, this is you know, so parents are instructing their children by the way that they interact with these things as well. And so, you know, it's not just a thing that encourages parents, it encourages children to be polite, but it does highlight that the way that we communicate with these things matters. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem like it does. You kind of look at it abstractly and, you know, what does it matter? It's a phone or it's a little robot. But the way that we have this conversation is important. And so it is cool to see that this is an additional thing that, you know, I don't think it's just for kids. Like, I really think that it will probably change the way that I talk to mine as well.
Yeah, we're nothing if creatures of habit, right?
Yep.
And just reinforcing that habit is helpful.
Would you like to see this taken to the next step and gamified? You know, give kids actual, like, there are tangible benefits to being polite to an assistant?
I think, as a parent, I would want control over that. And I think Alexa is probably the best suited for that right now with the way that they have their routine set up to build games. Mm-hmm. That Google Home doesn't currently have, because you can make it like, you know, I have a chore chart that my kids can pull from. These are the things that I have said that you need to get done today.
Right.
And so, like, you know, weaving a you know, an attitude thing into that would be instructive. I would be interested to see how that would work, but I wouldn't want a pre-programmed system that Google had created that I didn't have any control over.
I may have missed this in the keynote, but was there any talk of like negative consequences if you don't ask Google nicely? Like, would it ask you to say, like, what's the magic word?
You get Samuel Jackson to swear your kid, obviously.
I like the idea that they're trying to encourage speaking to these assistant platforms in natural language, because obviously if we, I wrote something about this a couple weeks ago where I was saying the best thing that you can do to make these assistants improve is to stop talking to them like robots ourselves, because we have this kind of preconception like, okay, it's a computer or a robot or whatever. You need to talk to it like this, nicely and slowly and clearly, so that it picks up all the things. But that doesn't help it learn, you know, overall.
Right.
You want it to reach a point where it could listen to something like a back and forth podcast and pick out the right words and know what to do. The problem is that middle ground where it's really frustrating and you're saying, no, shut up. You know, shut up. No, really, stop listening to me. That kind of thing is... that doesn't get us there either.
Right.
So how, you know, we're just sitting here waiting for Google to improve, or Amazon, or Apple, I guess, eventually, improve to the point where you don't have to talk to it like it's dumb. Because right now, they are the assistants still are pretty dumb.
But I think maybe part of the problem is that we interact in day-to-day not just with Home Assistant or with Google Assistant itself, but a lot of voice systems that take input that are nowhere near as good as what Google has. So
right.
Until yeah. Like the general,
my ATM needs to be smarter.
Exactly. Yeah.
To,
yeah.
Right, or the stupid and phone tree when you call the airline.
And just to put this out there, like the way a big way to get me to talk nicer to my Google Home or my Google Assistant is to let me name it.
Not
I don't think that's going
to
come.
That weird G-word.
I
don't think that's happening. It just doesn't seem like something Google's interested in.
Which is weird.
Yeah. They want to make Google Assistant a brand. Or Google, Google an assistant brand, an AI brand. And
the second you take...
It's so awkward.
The second you take the Google out of the activation phrase and move it from a separate personality away from Google, unless that had been the idea from the beginning, like it was with... the Amazon name that I shall not mention. Huh. Unless they set up a separate identity from the beginning, then I don't think that's...
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think it's something that we're going to get, but I think that does actually help. I know that I
probably would, yeah. Yeah.
So, last thing with assistant visual improvements to the phone. You were kind of snarky about this during the keynote, which was interesting, Russell. I'm pointing at you like, everybody knows what I'm doing, unless you're watching the live feed, which is
great radio here.
You were saying that this isn't the first time we've seen improvements to visuals on an assistant in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean the visual stuff was stuff that we got announced last year as things that were going to tie into your Chromecast, and it never really worked very well.
Right.
When you did the hey, start my day, it was supposed to go to your Chromecast and show you your weather and your traffic and all that stuff, and it was supposed to look really cool. And so all of those features were things that we had seen already, but it never really worked. You know, trying to get stuff to cast to the television, even like movies, do something from Netflix on my Chromecast,
right.
Never really works very well right now. But this is their way of solving that, is making the display part of the system. So these are the live displays.
Smart displays
that are being built in, and they look very nice.
And we have a release date for them now.
We do.
Well, release month, anyway. They'll be around in July. So that's probably a ballpark for these features arriving across the board.
And that's going to be the Lenovo smart display.
Yeah, Lenovo.
That's like
LG.
The reference one. Yep, there's LG, Sony showed one. They had about almost 10 manufacturers that were on board.
Quite a few on board, yeah. And interesting to see that many people involved. I mean, look, the technological commitment to building one of these is, the barrier to entry is pretty low.
They're all kind of the same.
Yeah, for a big consumer electronics brand, why wouldn't you at least attempt to make one of these, especially if Google's swinging the deal in other ways. But
right.
see how we go.
And you can also now use Assistant to order ahead at places like Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, Domino's.
Which is the exact same thing they announced last year.
Is it?
Yes, only the demonstration we got on stage last year was Panera Bread, where you could order your thing from Panera Bread.
This was a little bit different in that it knew what your standard Starbucks order was based on the information in your account, right? So it was just a step-by-step order of you ordering a sandwich.
And if I understand how Actions work, it actually pulls from your Starbucks app on your phone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, makes sense.
So it you know, a lot of that information is already there for being able to pull an order. And really, that's how this works, is that, you know, if you have an app on your phone, the developer can add action hooks so that it pulls into Assistant, and like the menu for Starbucks showed up, and you can go through and pull those things. But you still, it's not just a, you know, I've never been to a Starbucks before, let me just pull up my phone and do this thing. It's pulled into an experience you already have, which is good.
And it's also with specific apps, so it has to be a partnership. They said it's DoorDash, Starbucks, Applebee's, Domino's, 7-Eleven, Just Eat. I don't know what Just Eat is.
Just Eat is like a takeout delivery.
Okay, Dunkin' Donuts and Panera Bread.
Yeah,
there's
we have
the
in Canada, right? Yep. Just Eat.
DoorDash is dangerous for me personally.
DoorDash is very dangerous.
It means I can get Pokeballs delivered to my house with just my face. And
we know how Russell loves Pokeballs.
Not enough barriers to entry there.
And Pokeballs.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true.
Shout out
pretty much the word poke. I'm a fan. I mean, anything you put
Facebook
after that.
Poke as well.
Yeah.
Russell's a fan.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to Google Duplex. This was super interesting.
Geez.
Yeah. Okay, Alex, walk us through this demo. This was very, I think, for me, it was the most interesting and most evocative demo of the entire
Everybody's
keynote.
Talking about this.
But what is it? So when you think of talking to assistants, usually it's you that, you know, you're having an interaction with Google in a way that, you know, both sides know what's going on. This takes it a bit further in that Assistant acts as an intermediary with another person. It, you know, it is very much what an assistant would do, right? It's the task of
exactly.
a personal assistant. And it's this demo showed Assistant calling and making an appointment for a hair cut. You tell Google, okay, make me a hair appointment between 10 and 12 tomorrow. Presumably you know where you're calling and you would, all that information is already in your account. And then Google goes and makes a call to this business and navigates speech with another human and reports back to you when it's done its job. And we saw a demo of this. It is, you know, obviously it's easier to get away with pretending to be a machine, pretending to be a human over the phone, because the call quality obviously isn't
sure.
the same as a real in-person interaction. So, easy to see that. But yeah, this was very much sounded like two people just having a conversation. You wouldn't, if Google hadn't said that it was a computer on their end invoking this call, then yeah, you wouldn't be able to tell. There were the nuances of speech there in terms of like ums and ahs.
Sounds creepy.
I have a photo here of what the first
right.
line was. Says, "Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client."
And that is probably that encapsulates the most problematic thing of this.
Right.
Ethically, basically, because the whole point of this service is, it's to a large extent, is to deceive the other person.
Yep.
And maybe that's too strong a word for it, but I think basically it is, by opening with that,
it never
you are
addresses the fact
yeah, that you are basically lying by omission, is the argument there. It's a difficult point, right? Because the whole point of it is that, you know, obviously if it was to say upfront that it was an AI, most people would hang up. There is obviously kind of,
you think so?
I think a large number of people would, especially
would.
Business owners, right?
So
but
Google has said that it will disclose, that it's adding disclosure
but
to this process.
They said that, but they said they don't know how yet. And
no.
like obviously because it's a very difficult problem to solve. Interestingly, they have said that there's some kind of ultrasonic thing that it does at the beginning, so that another computer could detect that Assistant is on the line. But that just brings up potentially. So if this ever becomes widespread, would you then see like telephone systems that were able to detect that ultrasonic thing and just not answer?
Has to be.
I mean,
look at look at what your Pixel already does, and lots of carriers already offer. They know scan call likely,
exactly.
whatever, and the Pixel will now automatically detect robocalls and immediately, they won't even ring your phone.
Right.
Yet now Google is making robocalls to businesses.
It's already elevating these robocalls. It's giving these robocalls a sense of legitimacy.
Yeah, I mean, look, robocall kind of implies that it's unsolicited, which... Or it's marketing or it's something.
Yes,
you know,
sure.
This is very much a call with a purpose, just...
Sure. And robocalls are broadcasts. I mean, you're not the only one getting it.
Yeah.
Millions of people are getting the same call, whereas this is a bespoke robocall, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's something unique to the business being called. And
I think the second demo, the one with the restaurant booking, was more interesting because of its ability or of assistant's ability to recover after fumbling.
Well, yeah, it also showed the limits of the system, right?
Yes.
Because it navigated those fumbles by re-asking the question and trying to clarify, right? It couldn't navigate it like a human being could. And I think that was like, if you read the blog post after, something it pointed out is like, our system is really good, but only in these very specific circumstances.
Right.
Like, this is not a generalist AI that could start pretending to be something it's not.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, so for example, like, if you directly ask it, are you a robot? What would the answer be?
It would have to say yes,
to, right?
Ethically. Yeah. It would just have to acknowledge.
Yeah.
But what happens then? Hey, robot, I don't want to talk to you. Can you get your owner on the phone? Like,
yeah.
It's like your parent.
Yeah.
You know, can
so
you get your mom on the phone?
So that's the important thing about how this works. The idea is that you could have Google Assistant on your phone, and either by voice or by text, you say, make a hair appointment for me at 10 a.m. at such and such place.
Mm.
And then, unbeknownst to you, like, you're not watching it happen. The assistant on the server side is making that phone call, and then once it gets confirmation from the person on the other end, just feeds you a little card in Google Assistant that says, your appointment has been booked for XYZ time at ABC Place.
Yeah. If you guys recall, too, like, this is something that Facebook tried with M, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it eventually just shut down that part where there was the human component where, like, the Facebook employee would come into a conversation to steer the conversation. And it seems like Google might be forced to do something similar in the sense that you're that employee where you have to come jump into the conversation and steer it.
Yeah.
I had an original, my original thought with this was that this wasn't like a product yet.
Yeah.
Mm. And I was wrong. It wasn't something that they said on stage, but in the blog that came out afterwards, this is something that Google wants to deploy to users in limited fashions by the summer, within the next month or two.
Yeah.
Actually, interesting to look at the technology behind this because you probably wouldn't be able to do anything of this scale if you didn't have that ability to completely synthesize a voice from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, part of it is just, if you want to successfully emulate a human on the phone, then obviously you want a lot of different voices to draw from so that when they answer the phone, they don't immediately just recognize the Google voice.
Coming in 2019, the Android Central podcast hosted by Google Assistant.
If I could just ask you guys, what's your thought on this? Like, I was on two minds of this where it's like, on the one hand, this is going to replace a lot of jobs if it's successful, right? Like, this is a field where, you know, people have personal assistants.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know,
it's easy to imagine the reverse of what we saw, right? When you call a business and it's an AI answering.
Right. But on the other hand, you know, for me, it was interesting because it's like, there's a lot of people for whom this would be really beneficial to have. Like, it would take away so many, like, burdens, right? Or it would make it more accessible to have a personal assistant, right? So I was just wondering what you guys thought about that.
I think we're a ways away from this replacing an actual person, but it doesn't, it's clear that that's the goal. And I think that someone who has like a dedicated personal assistant, there's a long list of expectations there that go beyond talking to my phone and getting something done. I think that there's certainly a physical component to that that isn't going to replace it anytime soon. But it does create room for something that Daniel had said a couple days ago. The mom with two kids who's really busy doing something who really needs to make an appointment for something.
Right.
You know, like that. It instead of replacing people, I see this as creating, creating experiences for people that would never have been able to afford a full-time helper for something,
but at least initially.
Yeah.
I think the other part of it, at least for me, is that, I don't know about you guys, but I don't even trust the Google Assistant's ability to do most things that I ask it consistently.
No.
So I don't even trust my Google Home to be able to reliably set a reminder for me for a specific time for a specific thing on the first try. So it's going to be really tough to go that massive step up to say, I trust that I can say, book me a haircut appointment at this place at 10 o'clock, and it's going to call the place and make an appointment and then relay that back. It can't even.
There are so many extra points of failure.
Yes, it's one thing to be pleasantly surprised when you get a reminder and you go, "Hey, that actually worked." It's another thing to show up at the barber shop.
Exactly.
And be like, "Oh, hey, I actually have an appointment."
Without having to, you know, it's just there is a lot of extra mental burden on you with these systems just because you know that they're nowhere near perfect.
And also that one time where you go and you don't have a barber's appointment because something failed, that is going to be the last time you use that feature.
Especially if the call goes wrong and you step in and the barber is like, "Are you the guy who had the robot call?"
Yeah.
Like, we need to have a conversation.
Yeah, I'll meet you up.
Your robot was very impolite. Yeah. Like that.
I mean, it's also worth pointing out that there is so much potential for abuse here.
Yeah.
The businesses themselves, many of which don't have online ordering systems because they're small businesses and they can't afford the platforms that larger businesses have.
So what if Google instead came up with a good product to help these companies get online and take online appointments,
sure,
rather than having them get spam called by robots?
Yeah, and I mean, at the end of the day, it just comes down to it adds another layer of friction to a system where, you know, customer service is already a fairly it's a fairly exploitative industry anyway. This is just going to exacerbate that if its adoption gets to the point where a lot of people decide to make these calls instead of pursuing other avenues because it's so easy.
Yeah.
So there's serious concerns ethically about should this happen.
Yeah.
And Andrew and I pointed out yesterday, this is just a stopgap. It's a stopgap until all ordering is done digitally and online.
Yeah.
This is just for the companies that don't have these platforms at the moment.
Maybe the thing that you're talking about that helps businesses get improve their digital ordering experience, maybe that thing is a box that reads the ultrasonic thing that the Google Assistant picks up on, that Google sells to your business, and maybe that's the way to do
that. Because I totally understand that not every business is going to have an app.
Sure.
Or, you know, or a or even a good website that's easily machine readable.
Have you seen most,
you know,
restaurant websites?
Exactly. So I understand, and that's why things like OpenTable exist and are just massively dominant, because it was an easy way for, you know, restaurants to just put their availability and then all the heavy lifting's handled somewhere else. I feel like this is indeed a stopgap from Google. They could definitely go that next level to actually, because I don't think this is doing anything to help the businesses. This is adding a burden to the businesses.
Yeah, I mean,
you could potentially be facing lots of these robots.
You could argue that it makes it better for the business because
it offers a business.
The user might not ever get around to making that reservation.
Sure.
Were it not for the that's a tenuous argument.
I mean, that's
the
net positive.
Yeah.
I think there are arguments on both sides.
Sure.
Okay, let's move on.
Digital well-being.
I think this will be sort of the sleeper announcement of the show, because it puts Google in a spot where at once it's trying to discourage users from abusing the time on their phones and actually trying to get users to be aware that phone addiction is a thing, while also at the in subsequent sessions encouraging developers to make their apps more addictive.
Right.
So.
I'm sorry, why was I going to make that?
Exactly. So let's walk through this. There were a bunch of different tools that Google announced for its digital well-being platform. And Igor, did you get a sense of what the cohesive whole was among these announcements?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing here is just giving you kind of the tools to see how you're using your phone, how much you're using your phone. And I think really the key piece is when you are using your phone, what are you focusing on, right? Like, is it YouTube that is eating up your time? Is it Gmail, right? Is it Instagram? Mm-hmm. And I think for many people, that is an important first step, because we are kind of our own worst, like, accountants when it comes to our time.
Mm-hmm.
We always in most cases, underestimated or overestimated, right? And I think for a lot of people, just being able to open up that dashboard, see what they're spending their time on, and setting limits. Now, how effective it's going to be is going to be, I think, a really interesting piece, because
in the end, it is still a tool.
It's still a tool.
Just giving you that information. It's up to you about how you act on it. And it's a, you can kind of trace the origins of this back a little bit through to HTC Sense Assistant, I think, did it. It's like if you had a day where you were on your phone constantly, it would say, okay, maybe in the evening, it would say, notice you've been using your phone a lot, maybe take a break. Mm-hmm. This takes that core idea and just gives it more, well, gives you more information through this new dashboard area in Android that actually shows what it is that has been using your time over a long period, so not just that day.
And that's what it is a dashboard.
Yeah, yeah.
They
announced something, let me just check the name, because it was part of YouTube as well, because obviously, you know, YouTube is about more than just.
I have the photo here of the dashboard,
right.
And so it shows you a pie chart of time spent, and it gives you this circle, and it says, well, this example is 3 hours and 22 minutes total, and it says there's other YouTube, Netflix, Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, Chrome, Gmail as little slices of the pie. And then it says the number of times you have unlocked your phone today and the number of notifications that have come in.
And the YouTube feature on this, actually the YouTube area in the YouTube app looks similar to the slide you're looking at now. It's called Take a Break, I think, the feature.
Yes, Take a Break Reminders.
Yeah, Take a Break Reminders.
Where you can say settings and you set a threshold. Again, it's you setting a threshold to say, after I reached 1 hour of Netflix or YouTube watching in this case, remind me that I have spent an hour.
So even more so, you can set limits per app. So if you abuse YouTube every Sunday, you know I'm going to set myself an hour of YouTube a day, and the app actually turns gray after that time. And when you tap on the app icon, it says, are you sure you want to allow yourself to re-enter this, you addict? I don't think it adds the you addict, but it implies that. So this is one part of the new digital well-being features. The other part comes down to tools for do not disturb, Alex. And I think this is something that
they say switch off and wind down.
More people can appreciate, because we already use do not disturb automatically, many of us, before we go to bed. It turns off our notifications. It turns off our sound, silences our phone.
I've been trying to use it so much more.
It's really helpful.
I never actually turn mine off. I don't know if
I never
want anybody to disturb me.
So you're the perfect person for this, because it gives you more granular options.
Yeah.
You turn your phone on its face, and it automatically turns on...
Shush is the gesture. Yeah.
And it will allow you to, when your phone's on Do Not Disturb, but you're using it, so that if the screen's on, you can also choose not to receive notifications. You won't see notification dots, for instance. It's much more granular.
Yes,
so
the
display part of it is important. Hiding it in the notification tray is just as important as keeping the tone out of your ear.
Correct.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the Android P beta right now, and there's block visual disturbances, but they have different settings for when the screen is on and when the screen is off. You can just hide the dots or just the status bar icons, or don't pop notifications on the screen. Like, they just come in silently in the background. You can also have it not wake for notifications, like not have the lock screen turn on. All this kind of stuff, they're just a set of checkboxes. You can turn on and off the ones you want. And also, by default in the Android P beta, when you turn on Do Not Disturb, there is no time limit on it.
Mm.
It is just on or off, and you have to go into the settings and turn on the option to have it automatically turn off.
So we've got a little bit of background on this, actually. Glenn Murphy, one of the UX directors at Google for this and some other stuff, did a panel earlier today, actually, on building healthy technology. And one of the things that they talked about in the process of building these features was, instead of creating automated profiles that would just kind of guessed what it is that they wanted, a ton of user feedback on this leading up to the announcement of the features came. There was no unified profile that they could build for any one person. Where Google was like, this is totally the set of features that you want. Though what people wanted when it came to this kind of digital well-being thing was just so far scattered to the wind as far as options, that what Google opted for is this platform that creates just this awareness and control. You know, give people as much information as possible so they can see what it is, and then as many options as possible to control these notifications. And that's how this whole system came to be, instead of the more automated system that I think Sense was using back in the day.
And we noticed things, and of course, the Android P beta is not finished its beta, but when you, they have a lot of tool tips now around notifications where when you swipe away a notification for the first time, it says, would you like to never receive notifications from this app?
I think it
again,
also...
and you say yes or no.
It's a lot easier to...
I'm not sure it's the first time or if it
yeah.
reads... Sorry to interrupt. If it reads how often you dismiss those notifications. So if you always dismiss a notification from an app, it will give you the option to block all subsequent ones.
And also, we actually saw a rudimentary version of this with the Pixel Buds because it does audio notifications. And after you've ignored a notification a couple times, it says... Why don't you go into the settings and turn off notifications for this app?
Yeah, I forget how it phrases it, but yeah, the gist of it is that.
If you don't want to hear notifications from this app again,
I
would go turn it off or whatever.
So these are good things, I think, and we should be happy that they're there. They're only going to be launching in Android P. And
I don't think Overview is there right now, is it? I think
no,
not
probably
the next.
Only the Do Not Disturb features are here. And we're going to revisit this once... Android P goes public and is final. So we're going to skip the Google News announcement because I think that's interesting. It's a Google News overhaul. It replaces Play Newsstand in the Play Store. It will replace Google News as a portal online very soon. It uses the new Material theme, which is sort of Material Design 2, but is a little bit more extensible. I'd like to revisit that next week.
One small thing on that before we move on. Interesting to note how Google is very specific and noted on multiple points that when it shows you a story on this, it is doing the same analysis for everyone, and everyone is getting the same news.
Right, that's
to
a good point.
Which is sort of a counter to the way Facebook does it, which basically just it figures out what you want. It tells you what you want to hear. It's easier to live within your own bubble in terms of views and opinions. If you get your news from Facebook, and obviously Google wants to create something that is basically the antithesis of that.
Yeah, it's called full coverage, and it gives you sources from all sides of the spectrum. Obviously, Google's not writing its own news, so it's curating it from other sources that it trusts. And
basically a good thing, I think, that the question to be had around that is this farming out the idea of discerning, you know, objective truth to Google and its AI, and is that a good idea? But that's a discussion for another time.
Moving on, let's talk Android P. So this, I think, took up a lot of the keynote for a good reason. We've seen the first developer preview. We saw it earlier, when February? March?
March, yeah.
Early
so
March?
So it's been a couple months now.
So this was the announcement for the first public beta. You can sign up at google.com/android/beta, opt in your Pixel 2 plus one of seven phones from other manufacturers, which is really interesting. And once upgraded, you get the new gesture navigation scheme.
It's the best thing ever. It's the worst thing ever.
You've written takes that are hot of this.
Yeah.
Walk us through exactly what the update entails.
Do you want to start with the gestures?
Let's gesture first, and let's move from there.
So, people are overreacting, obviously.
Okay, enough. That's done.
they think it's... Well, because it's not finished. It's not even close to finished. It's not even turned on by default, even though this is a developer preview, beta, whatever. But it does show that Google is ready to offer up its own gesture navigation as a counterpoint to these individual manufacturers coming up with their own gesture navigations and saying, I'm sure you can still do your other thing, manufacturers, but if you want to include gestures, like, this is going to be the default. So it is a little bit like iOS 10 on the iPhone 10, in that you're swiping up from the bottom to get your, you know, side-scrolling now cards of individual apps. You can switch between them. You can still do a quick swipe to go back to the previous app, like a double tap of the Recents key currently.
Mm-hmm.
But the back button hasn't disappeared yet, and I think that's the kind of next... that's the other shoe that's waiting to drop, is how are they going to do the back button? Because it's smart in the way that when you're sitting on the home screen... there's no back button available.
Right.
Because you can't go back to anything, which is rather intuitive that you shouldn't have that button that you can just sit there and tap currently and it just vibrates and does nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It goes away, and then it shows up when you're in an app because you can hit back to go back out of the app. But that doesn't look good, as we've all identified. That little back button sitting there doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, we don't have an additional gesture to go back. You could easily just see it being a swipe left on that bottom bar. But
you can easily question how intuitive that might be compared to just a button.
Right. So you can easily, you can question how intuitive all of these gestures are.
Well,
this has kind of been the problem a lot of people have recognized with gestures on the iPhone X is you have to learn them. It is not, like, you need tooltips. You need learning as a first-time user of these things. You could hand a Pixel 2 with Android P on it to somebody, and it's not at all intuitive what you do to get to these things.
So something else that's pretty interesting about this. This is changing the way that the buttons look at the bottom of the screen. This dynamic has been with us for a long time. And one of the sort of problems around this has been burning with OLED screens, right? We saw Pixel 2 XL. Something that has struck me about the way this operates is it's a lot more dynamic, and there's a lot less that stays in the same place at all times. So, for example, when you drag out to go to the overview menu, the tab actually moves. The back button isn't shown at all times.
Right.
There's a lot more about this that is probably friendlier to OLED going forward.
Yeah. The thing I would say about this is the only really legitimate criticism I've heard is that, you know, the kind of genius of the gesture navigations on the iPhone X is that it just gets rid of software buttons completely, right? Which this, at least at this point in time, does not yet, and it's something that, you know, in what sense, like, it doesn't really make sense to kind of abstract the navigation of it if you're not going to get rid of the buttons completely and deal with this issue that's been with Android since
you're not saving any space in this.
Yeah, you're not saving any space, right? So that's the only concern that I think is really legitimate at this point, but I think we'll see, like, there'll be an option to not have any buttons at all.
If you go all gesture, I don't know, you could with this kind of setup, you could easily have that area that is just capacitive that doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You could even be off screen at the bottom bezel.
So the rest of Android P right now, the fact that it switched to beta means that we're getting more of, like, the gesture stuff, more of the actual substance of Android P that we can see, because the first developer previews were really just the O interface with a couple things tossed in.
Yeah.
This doesn't seem like a final color scheme or design of the notification shade and the settings and stuff like that. That all seems very unfinished. So I'm withholding judgment there. We also have a situation where the Pixel is going to look different from every other phone that runs P, and it's also waiting for updates to Google Apps, waiting for updates to the Pixel Launcher, which we know changes a lot of things mm-hmm. in the way that the phone's personality kind of is. But you have the new battery settings are in here, which are really cool. I want to know what your guys' thoughts are on. This is kind of the same thing as the well-being thing. It's just giving you information, not necessarily giving you a ton of toggles and switches and stuff you can do to extend your battery life.
So, I mean, this is one of those AI features that was announced at the keynote. It's called Adaptive Battery, and it's basically an extension of what Google's been doing with Android for, 5 years now? Every year they claim with a new version, it will learn the way you use your phone and optimize the way that the apps in the background are connecting to the internet and downloading data and, you know, initializing wake locks and things like that. Dave Burke, who leads the Android engineering team, said that adaptive battery is so good because it's learned from so many Android phones over the last few years that it will increase your battery life on the same phone by up to 30%. Unfortunately, right now, there are no granular controls. It's either on or off, which means you can't really tell. I'm not sure if you'll be able to eventually tell one app not to be part of adaptive battery. Like, if you know you need Twitter updates in the background every hour, like me,
Daniel,
I would choose not to have that as part of the adaptive battery program.
Right, there's no... I'm thinking about the way that Samsung does it currently, which is very much a blacklist, whitelist.
Or Huawei, which bugs you literally every time a new app uses any battery.
You have a situation on Samsung phones where you can say, where it says, if you haven't opened an app in 3 days, it kind of puts it more in a little bit of a hibernation mode, so
yeah.
It can't, you know, keep waking up. But at the same time, you may not use, you know, like an airline app, for example, unless you're like one of us, you don't use an airline app every 3 days. But when you need it, you really need it, and you don't want that thing to be going to sleep just because you didn't use it in 3 days. Well, my last flight was 6 months ago. You know, these are the things that AI is supposed to solve. And they're talking also about a situation where there are like tiers of apps. So they actually show in the adaptive battery settings that they have like chat apps bundled together, and then like calendar apps, and then other things like maps and you know, ticketing apps or something like that, that have different priorities based on what the percentage of your battery is. So when you have full battery, more apps get more access to things. When your battery is at 20% or 5%, you're only going to get access to the apps that you use most frequently. And that's the kind of thing that is helpful over the course of one day to the next, rather than having this whitelist, blacklist situation that may not help you the same in each day or week.
Yeah. I should also point out that the same feature is coming for brightness.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So that dovetails nicely. So this is what I call smart people-first features.
Correct.
In Android P.
And it's this is super smart.
Which is kind of a well-being thing in saying, we looked a lot at how people use their phone and what these extra pain points were. And so we made a bunch of changes. So it's things like the volume controls. When you hit the volume controls, the setting pops up next to where the volume controls physically are on the phone.
Mm.
And it pops up and it shows you a slider that you slide vertically up and down, rather than being at the top of the screen sliding left to right, which is the hardest function to make with your thumb when you're holding a phone in one hand. Why would you have to reach all the way up to the top? Also, they recognize that people adjust media volume more than ringer volume. So when you press volume up and down, it moves media volume by default, and it gives you one press to mute the phone or toggle to vibrate. Auto brightness, like you were saying, it's no longer just a sliding scale of ambient brightness is X, we set screen brightness to Y. It's read ambient brightness, see where you set the brightness yourself, and then start to learn where you like the brightness to be in certain situations and adjust accordingly. Also very smart, we've all, especially with the number of phones that we go through, they all have different auto brightness tendencies.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And they're not, you know, not only are they not the same from phone to phone, but they're not the same as you want them. Auto rotation, two-factor auto rotation. When you turn the phone, it gives you a button to confirm that you want it to rotate. And then when you rotate it back, you have to do the same.
To be fair, that is only in rotation lock mode, and actually kind of interesting.
Yes.
Rotation lock is on by default now.
Yes.
Thank God.
So it,
I don't know.
It's a situation in which
I'm like,
for example,
this is a solution in search of a problem.
No. So you're
how often are you doing this?
Do you remember
all the time?
Do you remember when Steve Jobs first went up on stage and showed auto rotation and how magical that seemed? And now we have it.
Now we
hate actually, it. We have a button, so we don't have to deal with it.
So the
oh my god,
it's mostly
why do we even phone?
It's mostly a situation of accidental auto rotation.
Yeah, yeah, when I get it.
The accelerometers and the gyroscopes are not good enough to tell when you're just quickly turning the phone, you know, accidentally, or you move it to the side, and then your phone does this thing where it rotates, and then you have to try to rotate it back, that kind of thing, without having to swipe down the notification shade, change auto rotate, wait for it to switch, and then tap the button again. You can also just leave it on auto. That works.
I mean, there are some dumb phones that aren't the Pixel that you put a phone down on a table or a
yes,
desk and it just rotates.
Yeah.
It has no idea what you're doing. So that I think is actually
pretty
useful. But for most of the other times, it's not. But let's talk a little bit about a couple of new features for developers that were announced at the show that I think will be quite interesting. So these are not Android P specific. They're app actions and slices. So these are, in addition to some changes to the Pixel Launcher, where it surfaces the five most popular apps that you tend to use. These are kind of predictive features that
are features within apps.
Features within apps that try to predict what you are going to do. So, for example, App Actions allow Spotify to plug into the OS to say when you plug in a pair of headphones or a dongle, whatever you do, or you connect a pair of
plugging headphones in,
or you connect a Bluetooth connect some Bluetooth headphones, open up this specific playlist, not just the Spotify app.
Pick up where you left off.
Yeah.
If it knew, for example, you were listening to a podcast when you last had headphones plugged in, perhaps when you plug those headphones back in, you're going to want to pick up where you left off with that podcast.
Sure. And it's also context specific. So if you're in a particular location, it's sort of like a beacon. It can allow you to do certain things on your phone when you walk into a movie theater, for instance, or would you like to buy more popcorn? I don't know, something like that. Slices, I think, are even more interesting. And that's because they are basically, we're moving to this stage of headless apps where apps can exist without you actually tapping the app button. And this allows, slices allow developers to build parts of their app into the Google Assistant. So it gave the example of Lyft. You open up Google Search or you ask Google Assistant to look up Lyft, and it will give you the ability to order Lyft from the search results because it knows your location. It can give you the exact price and how long it'll take you to get to various places in your favorites list. What do you think about this, Igor?
So in kind of seeing it work in action and talking to some of the team that worked on this, the one thing that I got the sense of is that I feel that this feature might not be really discoverable for a lot of users. Personally, I'm not of the type who really goes into the search, taps the search bar to kind of complete function or complete tasks. I don't know, like, I'd have to like use it more to get a sense of how good it is at predicting certain things. There's slices within the Pixel Launcher, right?
Mm-hmm.
But is it always going to deliver the ones that I necessarily want? I think in the idea is fantastic. I'm just kind of waiting to get more time with it before I decide whether it is ultimately really useful to most
people. I mean, we've had, like, this idea of compartmentalizing portions of apps and making them available in other parts of the interface is not new at all. It just hasn't been executed well ever, you would say. All of these ideas trying to break down the paradigm of jumping in and out of specific apps it's all admirable, and I hope that it happens, but it's a really hard thing to do. And like we were talking about with the assistant before, as soon as it doesn't work once, you just don't do it again. And so that cuts down on the discoverability. Like you said, we are not already, we're not trained to just go to the search box and type the thing we want. We know where we put the icon for Instagram on our home screen, and that's just muscle memory to go there. It's not muscle memory to start everything at the search box.
But it's also not hard, once you're familiar with the specific actions inside of an app, it's not hard to see this as kind of the natural evolution of the long press functions in the Google Home the Google Launcher.
Sure.
Where you long press and you see the different options that are available. Those options become available in the search box.
Predictably.
So I see that as being slightly different than kind of the failures of the past of offering those kind of shortcuts to applications. So I can see the use case there. I'm not sure how I'm going to feel about it. I do use the search box just to pull up apps if I don't want to go rummaging through my app drawer. But it could work well.
So the first time we can get all these features on phones that are not Google phones in preview, which is a huge deal, I think.
Right. So
nobody expected this.
Yeah.
No.
Because if somebody had suggested it, we would have laughed at them.
Yeah.
So what did this entail, Alex? Was this Google and even Qualcomm reaching out to these companies saying, we want you to participate?
Yes. Sorry. That's good, because I didn't know.
We got this answer Xiaomi yesterday.
Okay.
Okay.
Xiaomi told us a little bit about...
Xiaomi being a participant, the Mi Mix 2S,
the Mi Mix 2S
is available.
Xiaomi was approached by Google in order to set this up so that they could have access to Android P a little early, which is good for their non-Mi Mix 2 phones,
mm-hmm.
But also this version of the phone. But it's not exactly the same as what we get with the Pixels. The Pixels have the Android beta, mm-hmm. where they can sign in and request an OTA that gets downloaded,
yeah.
that flashes to Android. The Mi Mix 2 is normally running MIUI, and this is something you have to manually flash. And once you do that manual flash, you can continue to manual flash. Like, they will continue to support Android P, but it will never merge back to MIUI.
Right.
Right. So that raises a few questions. That, you know, actually, the broader issue that... what you're getting in here is not the same level of basic experience that you get on a Pixel. I think that the experience you see, it isn't identical, but I also think it isn't anywhere near as feature complete. You still, like, okay, this is still a developer preview, right? But you have the same, you have a basically complete Pixel UI on there that is feature complete. We were looking at this build on the Mi Mix 2S yesterday. You had the basic Qualcomm Snapdragon camera there. A lot of the UI stuff in some apps looked a bit weird. So
we have to remember there is a difference between Android P and all of the Pixel stuff.
Yeah,
which
so
is all completely
so what?
Separate.
Yeah, what you see on the Pixel 2 is more of a complete picture of what it'll be eventually when
yeah.
it gets that update. Whereas what you have on these phones, okay, it's still a basic version of Android P, but you don't have all these manufacturer features level on top. At least it looks like you don't so far. I can't speak for any of the other phones.
So my question is, you know, we talked about this with O beta last year, and eventually when it came to the Pixel 2 in October, it was a very different experience.
Yeah.
The gesture navigation is obviously the biggest visual and UX change that is available for us right now. But how does that inform what the Pixel 3 series will look like? How do you think this is pushing Google to, you know, this is clearly making Google setting the stage for the next generation of Android products.
I think the biggest thing we're going to, I mean, we kind of covered notches when we talked about the first developer preview. Pretty obvious to me, at least one of the Pixel phones will probably have a notch this year. Gestures as well, I mean, we talked about this before. I don't think this is going to change the way phones look, because you still have that trade-off where you have on-screen buttons, you lose a chunk of the screen. I don't really see that changing unless Google has a radically different way of implementing that on its own phones. Based on the fact that gestures aren't enabled by default
right.
in the current version, I think we'll have this sort of transition period, much like we had when we went to on-screen keys like 6 years ago.
Oh my
where
God,
some phones will have capacitive, some phones had on-screen. I think the next year is we're going to be a mess of on-screen keys, of gesture setups, and probably not the same gesture setups.
I'm really excited to see Samsung mess this up, guys. This is going to be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no guarantee that everyone will do back when we first had on-screen keys, people put the keys in a different order. Samsung for a long time. Well, Samsung still does.
LG stuff like four or five more on-screen keys down there. They were just like, let's just add them all.
So
I think Q-Slide is the thing that people want.
They love it.
Thank you, Scott.
I think you raised a really good point, which is, like, I think we'll still see this deprecation between, like, a Pixel 3 XL and a Pixel 3, where, you know, the Pixel 3 is kind of the more, I don't even know how to call it, like, the less advanced, let's say.
Yeah.
But probably the better phone.
But probably the better phone.
All of us in this room have a Pixel 2 XL except me, so I don't know what that says. Battery?
Battery.
Okay. Anyway.
But it'll be interesting to see how they present that mm-hmm. come in October, where it's like, yeah, this is the one with the notch, this is one with the gestures, and then this is for all the, like, diehards who just want the classic Android experience.
Sure, moving you back to capacitive buttons again. You got the search key.
We've actually just re-released the G1.
Yeah.
Pixel
keyboard.
Go nuts.
So all of the phones, I don't think we listed, it's the Nokia 7 Plus, the OnePlus 6 once it comes out, Mi Mix 2S, Essential Phone, Xperia XZ2, Oppo R15 Pro, and the Vivo X21.
Can we also just talk for a second about how the OnePlus 6 release is the most protracted teaser campaign of all time? They basically announced this phone like six times.
How bananas is it that people are gonna be buying a phone with a developer preview on it?
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Because there are going to be people who are going to get that phone and are not even going to finish. Yeah, they're not even going to finish the initial setup. They're going to immediately put P on there as a beta. Some people just want to pee on their OnePlus 6, guys. Like this,
you got to claim ownership over it somehow.
So, I just think it's very cool, like to get a brand new phone that's going to run.
The phone hasn't even
finished.
Been announced yet,
right?
Yeah. So the reason we can do this is Project Travel, right? The reason we are able to have developer previews on more than just the Pixel devices is that we have this separation of the core Android stuff and the manufacturer stuff. So what you get on the Xiaomi phone is basically just the bare bones of Android without pretty much anything on the vendor partition. It's just like completely bone stock Android. It is possible. I think from what I've seen, the Essential Phone build of this is a little bit more, a little bit closer to the retail experience of that phone, just because that phone is so close to stock Android anyway.
Sure.
But with an Oxygen OS, maybe with Sony's setup, they might be able to do something where, they have parts of their own experience in there as well.
Sure.
It is certainly possible, but
even if it's just added later on, like not necessarily part of this beta 2, but like as you get closer to the final release.
Yeah. What's exciting to me about this is that this, not only are more manufacturers getting earlier access to Android, to future versions of Android, which is good for updates, potentially it means that day one, all the phones on this list are probably going to be have a pretty short wait for the final version.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe more with a OnePlus or a Sony or Essential than say, Xiaomi.
Yeah, the people we talked to from Xiaomi, they weren't willing to give like actual dates or anything, obviously, for when they felt like not just Android P on the Mi Mix 2S, but just the MIUI update to Android P.
Because MIUI itself is this whole separate massive
very
engineering
skinned,
there's a lot of stuff that will need to be.
They seem to think that this was going to dramatically reduce time to update. Wasn't just blowing smoke.
What's so funny about this, though, is that Harish, our writer in India, published the State of Oreo Updates in India post just 2 days ago.
Cool.
Xiaomi is actually near
the
bottom of that list because only a single phone of the Mi Mix and Mi Mix 2S, the Mi Mix 2 and 2S are on Oreo. One shipped with 8.1. The rest of their phones are still on Marshmallow and Nougat. Like, not
Marshmallow.
Oh, yeah.
Oreo was the starting point for this, like with Project Treble. So if they are positive about this, then this could be a very good thing.
So one thing that I wanted to mention about the first Android P beta is that Google is using haptics in a really cool way on here that it's never used before. And I appreciate that a lot. You turn on the phone, there's a very slight haptic. When you've always had it when you unlock, but when you open the notification shade, there's a little haptic.
It's really like scroll of
scroll,
like, almost like an old click wheel iPod if you've used one of those.
I'm here for this. Like, I'm not sure that this gesture scheme is going to ship in this format, but
sure,
I think it's like 80% there.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
It probably points to a pretty significant change in haptics in general on the Pixel 3.
Oh, I can't wait.
Pixel vibration core.
I love that idea only because Alex and I have tried the LG G7, thank you very much, and the haptic on that are amazing, so it's hard to go back to a phone that doesn't have amazing haptics. Anything else to talk about with Android P before we...
I was just going to say wind down when the screen turns grayscale. I am so excited for that. That's
how come?
One feature I love on the OnePlus 5T and Oxygen OS is the grayscale option for reading apps. Mm. And that's something I use a lot. And I think just the fact that, I am this person who checks their phone in the morning, checks their phone right before going to bed.
Right.
And I feel like, personally, this is something that's going to make a world of difference in my life. Mm-hmm. So
it might end up sleeping better.
Yeah.
2018 is the year where we have software that actively makes our phones suck so that we eventually want to put it back.
So we're just going to all buy light phones and just get away from this business altogether.
I do have one quick thing, because it wasn't part of the keynote, but there was a whole bunch of stuff here this year on AR Core. There was a bunch of different panels on building stuff for AR Core. There's actually more stuff here for AR Core this year than there was for Daydream, which was...
Yeah, Daydream wasn't mentioned after like a huge showing last year. Not mentioned at all.
But yeah, not mentioned at all in the keynote. But AR Core got its own kind of separate thing afterwards in several panels. The biggest thing that came from that is Cloud Anchors, which is not a very exciting sounding thing for something that is actually very, very cool. Cloud Anchors allows for augmented reality experiences to be shared across multiple users in the same space. So
that's neat.
I can create an augmented reality experience. I can fill this room with porgs. From the Pixel camera, and then I can say, Alex, come look at my porgs, and Alex can open up his phone and get a Cloud Anchor from me, not through a web connection, or through a web connection, not through an internet connection, and be a part of that same experience, be able to see everything that's there as soon as that gets set up. And there is no limit to, developers have an unlimited amount of resources when it comes to how many people can connect to these things. So you can effectively, you know, fill a room with an augmented reality creation, and 1,000 people can walk through like a museum.
So cool.
And have that access. And that's
I love
fantastic.
That it's local. I love that you don't need the internet for that.
It's local, and it's based on, there's not a lot of data that gets transferred. It's just location markers. When AR Core grabs like the dimensions of a table and shares that, when the other phone matches those dimensions, like, hey, I found the table, then it just connects.
Okay. So last couple of things that we could fly through. Google Maps and Google Lens. So Russell is a little skeptical on the uptake of Google Lens, and rightfully so. This year, it was more kind of more the same. Lots of big picture things that
well, they stuck
actually...
it in the camera now.
Yeah, I mean it's getting there. So
not just in Google's camera,
more camera apps.
And a lot of camera apps, which will be
starting with LG G7 ThinQ.
Real time stuff with Lens is a solid way forward. I think that's very, very positive.
So that means that you open up the camera and it's basically giving you information as you move the viewfinder around a room. You don't actually have to explicitly tap on an object to extract information from it. This could work if Lens is a useful product, if it can extract from
All anyone really wants is for their camera to tell them whether something is or is not a hot dog.
Is that a is that a dog or a hot dog?
And then secondarily, if it is a sandwich.
That's right.
Or thirdly... Is it a raccoon or a cat?
Yeah. Oh, wait, was that on the start? Did we start recording before?
Yeah, that was discussion.
You'll never know. It's one of those things where once it gets good, I think people will actually really quite, they'll be very excited to use it.
It has to be a thing that just happens, not a thing you have to go hunting.
So the really cool thing, though, is the Lens is coming to native camera apps on LG, Motorola, Xiaomi, Sony, Nokia, and TCL, OnePlus, and Asus phones. That's a lot of companies getting on board.
Yeah.
So, pretty cool stuff there.
And a lot more usage data to go back to Google to make it better, too.
So, do we start a countdown clock for when Samsung gives up on Bixby Vision?
Never. That is the hill they will die on.
They will die on that hill. So, lastly... Maps. This is kind of this was another sleeper announcement, but
I actually got a smattering of announcements.
I know. Maps. You will soon be able to vote on restaurants with your friends. Lots of social features being added to Maps.
Should we go here or here?
I'm gonna smack someone's phone out of their hand when they're like, "Let's go to McDonald's." No, Phil, you don't get a phone anymore.
He doesn't get a vote. He's down there doing. He's cutting the cord.
Yeah, you choose. You choose who to share to. So that's good.
And I think one of the really interesting announcements is that not only is Google Maps getting Google Assistant support later this year, but it's replacing that really unreliable blue dot when you are trying to find the direction of a location with an AR-powered street view.
Well, so that was an early demo of something that's not finished. It may not look like that by the time we get it.
We have a magical fox to show you. Oh, I'm not talking about the magical fox. I'm just talking about being able to point your phone in the direction
and it will give you an idea of where to go.
So it gives you...
It gives you arrows and
directions. Yeah, what they showed was
that
the top two-thirds of the screen are a camera view.
Yeah.
The bottom third of the screen is kind of that 2.5D angled navigation type look.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of can put the visual of the place with the visual of the position on the map together. So when it says turn right in this example, it kind of has these little blue arrows pointing to the right so that you have this visual reference of, okay, the pin is dropped over there, and also I can see that there's a Burger King across the street. I know that that's the pin,
mm-hmm.
and you know, kind of, just getting that initial orientation is what's important.
That's really hard.
It's easy to understand when you're in a car going 25 miles an hour down the road. It's easy for your phone to figure out that you're moving in that direction.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder when you're walking and kind of doing that spin around in circle thing.
I think also what's important here is this is their next big moneymaker. We've been reading a lot about this from reports from Bloomberg and stuff that, you know, the use case for this is you're inside a mall and it's overlaying ads on top of the augmented reality layer to, you know, get you to buy stuff.
Or
so.
Google Maps already does sponsored pins when you scroll across on the map at certain zoom levels. Companies can pay to have their stuff show up in those pins.
Final thoughts on I.O. You know, we've been here 3 days now. There's barely anybody left, but the sessions are still going on.
We're actually
going
to open this door and there will be no one in this room.
It'll be Friday by the time we end this podcast. I would say there haven't been any real, like, showstopper announcements, but at the same time, there weren't any real dogs. I mean, there was no Allo.
Sure.
I think that's important.
Yeah, one person had asked, I think it was on Twitter, asked of a few of us, what nothing about Google's RCS chat plans.
That's
not something for developers. The fact that we didn't hear about a couple of those types of things are not indicative that those things are not important.
Yeah.
We have to remember that.
So I think of all of the outdoor Google I/O, it was probably the smoothest so far. There was no, there were no issues getting in. There were no accessibility issues. There was no kitchen fire this year.
Shout out to the support staff, all the security people. They have been in remarkably high spirits and very positive. And
really good.
Even when people like walk across the street when a car is clearly right there, like.
And they take care of us. So it's a really gratifying experience being here. I think it's great seeing all of you in person, and we're gonna go out and we're gonna finish our recording, and we'll see you around. We'll be back next week in our remote locations
with
better audio quality and hopefully beers, because it's a little too early for that.
And hotter takes.
maybe
not hotter.
Luke or warmer.
It's pretty warm in this room right now.
Igor, thank you so much. It's been an honor having you. Really, really appreciate you coming out. This is your first I/O. Give me your quick take.
It's been so amazing, and just, you know, to get to meet in person some of these people who I've like respected and really admired for a long time. Like, you know, the AC crew is just been such a privilege. Everyone across the board is just the kindest, nicest, smartest people.
Oh yes, keep laying it on. It feels so good.
You can run another hour here
if we don't die of dehydration and exhaustion.
I just want to shout out to LaCroix, who is the best
sponsoring our podcast,
sponsoring the podcast this week unofficially. Russell, really good to see you.
Yeah.
Haven't seen you for a couple years, so really nice having you out. Alex, Andrew.
Yep, we see you.
Keep it real.
We were also here.
you were also,
present.
You were also.
People also in this room. Continue.
And everybody listening, thank you so much for tuning in week after week. We could not do this without you. That's it from Mountain View, California, Google I/O 2018. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Bye. Peace out.